1994. Interview by Thomas Golston with Kathleen Carlson Drayback. Kathy, I've explained, I've gone over a little bit with you the oral history project, and I guess we should start off with a brief introduction by you of yourself.
Well, like you say, my name's Kathleen Carlson Drayback. I was born in Seattle. My parents were Chester and Virginia Carlson. And I've resided in Alaska since 1961. And that's basically who I am.
Okay. To attempt to get this into focus, could you talk a little bit about the circumstances that brought you and your family to Alaska?
Well, yes, my my father had made a business arrangement. He owned the major portion of two fishing vessels, and he'd made a sort of a gentleman's agreement with the owners of I forget the name of the cannery now, I'm surprised. Sort of a gentleman's agreement. He was running into a little trouble with his business, and they agreed to have him fish for Pan-Alaska, seems to strike me as the name of the cannery. Don't believe it exists anymore. They decided that he would have to come to Alaska to fish these boats rather than fish off Washington. And so he decided that we would move, and he gave us the choice. We could either move to Unalaska or Kodiak. And it didn't take much description to decide that Kodiak was the better of the two choices in 1961. So we came here January 8th. Well, my parents preceded us, bringing one of the fishing vessels up, and my brother and I arrived in January.
Was this a Pan-Alaskan cannery based in Seattle or here in Kodiak?
Well, they must have had operations in Seattle. They must have. My father had dealings with canneries up and down Alaska, Washington, Oregon coast. His entire life was as a fisherman, so he'd fished mostly in Alaska, and that was another personal reason why he wanted us to move to Alaska. Was he had fished out of Alaska for many years, spending 4 or 5 months at a time away from us in Seattle. And he didn't like it. He never liked it, and he decided to remedy that by all of us moving to Alaska, and so we did.
For the purposes of the record, would you like to give the names of your mother and father?
My father's name was Chester Gerhardt Carlson, and my mother's name was Virginia Viola Popplewell Carlson.
Okay, thank you. How old were you when your family moved up to Alaska?
I was 13. I was in the 8th grade. My brother was 6, and we arrived on Pacific Northwest Airlines on a day much like today. Glare ice, cold.
That must have been quite a, I guess, shock for a teenager from Seattle suddenly finding themselves in Kodiak in 1961.
It was catastrophic. That was putting it mildly. I didn't think I'd ever get over it. I believe I cried for about 6 months. I was so stunned. I thought, how could you do this to me? I don't believe it. It was, my folks were trying to get settled here, and we didn't have, I don't believe they even had a car yet. They had a small home, one of the Aleutian homes, and I think we brought the, we, yes, we took the bus into town. And as we rounded Dead Man's Curve and came into town, I thought, no, you guys have to be joking.
It's embarrassing to admit now, but I still remember that ride. I'm 47 years old, and at 13, to be so narrow-minded, all I'd ever experienced was Seattle and then one summer in Soldovia. And when we drove into town, it was in that dirty little bus on the dirt roads. I thought, well, what do you mean? There's no pavement, there's no buildings, there's, I mean, it wasn't like a town. And I was shocked. I was just shocked.
You've sort of began answering some of my additional other questions. One of that was, as a teenager, what were your first impressions of Kodiak?
Well, I thought it was a dusty little bird that was beneath me. And I'm proud to say I've overcome that narrow-mindedness and got to see that there is beauty in knowing people. There is beauty in nature. And just meeting people who had been born and raised here and shared their enjoyment of this place helped. I got out and around the town with friends' families and, you know, started with drives to Chiniac and picnics at Pisag Shack and things like that. People telling stories about the villages and being raised in the villages and a whole different perspective on life. And you know, then I quit being big city stubborn and learned to appreciate it, which I do quite a bit now.
Is there any particular story that comes to mind that you were told that during those early days of exposure to Kodiak that still sticks out in your mind? Okay, continue.
When my parents came here, they brought the Virginia V up to Kodiak, and when they crossed from the mainland over through the Barren Islands and to Kodiak, they experienced 40-foot waves. My father said that in his entire life, and he was in his between 35 and 37, he had never experienced such a storm. Waves broke over the top of the boat. I have a vague recollection of the size of it. It was probably a 60-foot vessel, somewhere along in there, 60, 70-foot vessel. And my mother wrote a story about it. They talked about it. They would get excited and fearful every time they'd talk about it. It was just the engineer, my father, and my mom. She spent her time in the galley trying to keep things from flying around. And to do that, the drawers that had flown out and the water that was in the galley, the drawers were floating around in the galley. And so she sat in one and put a foot in one, another foot in another one to try to keep things somewhat stable. She didn't know where else to go. She felt she'd be the safest there. I do remember my dad said, "You stay here." And the engineer was in the engine room, and my dad was in the wheelhouse. And they made it through. They couldn't quite believe it, but they made it through. And it wasn't a forecasted storm or anything. They just were committed and crossed and experienced it.
That must have been some experience for you as a teenager, having your parents out at sea and your father a fisherman. Does anything come to mind in your recollections of being a teenager of a father who was a fisherman?
Well, yes, I remember when they left to go to Alaska, we were quite worried. My brother stayed with my sister and her family. She was an adult, had children, and lived in the Seattle area. And I stayed with an aunt and uncle. And we were worried the whole time. It took them 2 or 3 weeks, I believe, to get up all the way. And until we heard the call that, you know, they were there and they were fine, we were worried. And my dad was away a lot as a fisherman, and yes, it always worried us. You weren't safe, you weren't comfortable, you didn't feel safe or comfortable until they were on land.
Do you think that had any impact on you as a teenager, and if so, what?
Well, it was sort of strange that Daddy was gone a lot, and then when he was there, he was the most kindly disciplinarian there was, but it seemed strange. My mother was a little more liberal, and then here was Daddy, who was gone a lot, but when on land, he was quite exacting in what he wanted, expected, and things were pretty strict when he was home, and then not strict at all when he was gone, and then you were worried. So yeah, I'm sure it did.
Back to more relating to you as a teenager here in Kodiak, what, if any, are your recollections of the difference in, oh, just teenage life, the social scene of teenagers in Kodiak versus your relationship as a teenager, relationships as a teenager in Seattle?
Oh, well, it was a lot more unstructured, countrified, so to speak. I remember in Seattle, I'd reached the age where I could go to a dance or two. But I don't know, big city versus small town. At the time, in the 60s, I thought of it as kind of like a large village. It was more innocent fun, more unstructured, informal, spontaneous fun. You know, you'd walk along the beaches. You could do that. You could go to Knutson's store and, I don't know, just a walk downtown, and you wander down to Sportland and see who's playing the pinballs, and then you'd walk to Knutson's store, and that was right on the water, right next to Crafts, and it was a big deal to go buy some 45s, and I don't know, all the little pleasures were such a big deal here, whereas they hadn't been elsewhere. I'm not quite sure how to describe that. It was different.
Did in any way you feel that your family's move to Kodiak impact or affect the family's relations with other family members, extended family members?
Oh, yes, yes. That's one thing that's most noteworthy about Kodiak. Being an island in the middle of the Gulf, your connection to family outside of here is difficult. It was then, it is now. I had grown up living in Washington State, and if you wanted to visit someone, you know, they were either across town or just a few hours drive down the coast, something like that. It wasn't a big deal. Well, it's a major thing to go to and from Kodiak. My family in Washington thought of us as extremely adventuresome to come here. It completely cut us off from them.
I noticed that in your name, your maiden name is Carlson, and that's a name that I hear frequently here in Kodiak. Could you talk a little bit about, if any, connections your Carlson family lineage has to Kodiak Island and the history of Kodiak?
Well, I'm Carlson by birth. My father was all Norwegian, and there's lots of Scandinavian influence here. It's I'm not related to any of the Carlsons that are here. a lot of the Carlsons here are from Chignik area. I have no other Alaskan Carlsons. I have a family that comes and fishes over in the Bristol Bay area in the summer, but I'm not related to any of the local Carlsons, but it's not unusual that the name, because they're the Scandinavians, fishing is not an unfamiliar thing to them, so the move for Scandinavians to Alaska and fishing is just a natural course of events. I just don't happen to be related to any of the other Scandinavians here.
Okay. Going back to our major theme, what were some of the popular teen activities that you can recall while you were growing up in Kodiak?
Well, the big deal for 13 to 16-year-old girls here was, there were two things, and both of them were dances. There was teen club on base and rainbow girls dances in town. And you would die if you couldn't go to a Friday night dance. And the entire week was spent negotiating with parents who would take what group where. And there was lots of promises of house cleaning and many things that you would do to be able to get somebody's mother to take you. So I had a small group of friends that we cajoled our mothers into to doing just that. And then, so of course, then somebody else would have to pick you up and bring you home. It was, while my father was alive, it was out of the question that it be a boy that take you or bring you back. That was something parents did. There's no other way about it.
What comparisons have you made, if any, regarding your experiences as a teenager in Kodiak versus those of teenagers today?
As far as sophistication, I think that being a teenager in Kodiak in the 60s was nothing like being a teenager anywhere else in the nation in the 60s. We were at least one or two decades behind anything I ever heard or read about teen life in a big city. We were veritably country bumpkins in comparison. I can't think of anything specific, but when my peer group now looks back on our experiences, we're almost embarrassed at how different it was than the rest of America.
Do you have any specific recollections of your years in high school in Kodiak High School, with you as a teenager?
Well, the most noteworthy was the day that President Kennedy died. It was a school day like any other school day, and the first or second period of the day was in the library. It was a homeroom class where you had an opportunity to catch up on your homework, and some people actually did that instead of passing notes. And I think I was just coming out of homeroom class when Lynn Scapel told me that President Kennedy had been shot, and I thought, well, she was always a practical joker, sort of an outrageous practical joker. And my first thought was, that's not even funny, Lynn. I may have even said that to her. And then she said it enough times where I believed that it was true. That was the ultimate thing. But the positive side of teen years here, 62 through
65 was basketball games. That was what you did. You either went to a dance or you went to a basketball game or you spent the night at a friend's house or you ice skated. Those were the kinds of activities you did. I remember one time my father allowed me to have a party and invite boys and girls over. And it was my first real party. And at that time we were freshmen in high school, and the big thing here was boys owning mopeds. And my folks had food in the house, and so there was food and records. He hated my 45s, but for the party, he said I could play whatever music I wanted. And the girls and boys took turns, the boys took turns riding the girls around the block on their mopeds, but I couldn't go because that was out of the question. It just was, if the parents wanted the other girls to do such a thing, they could. But like I said, he was pretty strict, and he didn't approve of me having anything to do with motorcycles.
Sort of to give a helping hand and give some perspective on the interview, I'm going to ask you a series of questions. And essentially, I will state a name or an event, and as best you can, give me your recollection of your reaction as a teenager in Kodiak.
Okay.
Cuban Missile Crisis.
Well, the news we received on AFRN, which was the military station, was pitifully summarized. Between being a teenager and not caring much about national events, and the poor news coverage that AFRN had, I don't think it had much effect on me.
Okay, TV debates between Nixon and Kennedy.
Again, I have to complain a little about the military television service we had here. They sometimes put on broadcasts that had the wrong president being pictured on the wall. I paid attention to the Eisenhower-Stevenson debates when I was a child in Seattle, big time, because it was available to us. We had a narrow window of events, current events, coming to us across the television. So I don't recall them at all.
Okay. The assassination of President Kennedy.
That was big time for everyone in the nation. And we were off school for a week, or at least at least 2-3 days. I remember several days. The entire city was stunned, like the rest of the nation.
The assassination of Bobby Kennedy.
I was in Seattle at the time, waiting for an airplane, flying back. I believe I must have been 18 or 19 then. I was waiting for an airplane in the SeaTac airport with my mother and stepfather.
Do you recall any change in the atmosphere of your friends in Kodiak once you got back?
No. No, I don't. The thing that's unique about this island and being raised as a youth, it's not so much anymore, but back then, the isolation had a real effect. It's so easy for your world to be just here and here only.
Okay, the assassination of Malcolm X.
I don't even remember it.
Okay, the civil rights movement and the march on Birmingham.
Yes, I do. I was then old enough to become aware of events across the nation. And I thought, I started to have strong feelings about people's rights and
began to see beyond the walls of Kodiak.
Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech.
I think that, like anyone, that speech is, it's got a very strong effect, no matter what your political views are. Just the if you're human, it affects you.
I'm thinking more in terms of the impact that it had on you at the time as a teenager in Kodiak. Do you have any recollections of hearing the speech? Or
yes, I do.
Discussing it at school?
Yes, I did discuss it with friends. I did. Discussed it. I do remember feeling hopeful and positive and proud that such a movement was going on. And, you know, I wished that it would make a difference. And I remember discussing that with friends.
Along that same vein, did you have a sense that that speech was also applicable to the Alaskan natives here in Kodiak? Did you see it having an impact on how they as a ethnic group were treated?
I always had strong, yes, I do. I did then. When I was in high school here, when I started high school, Native children were not vocal about how much Native they were. The recording of who was how much Native was something that was done kind of under the table. And I remember being in wonderment about that, and when I ever would think about it at any depth at all, I'd be appalled that people would have to be ashamed. And it came to the forefront when I was a junior or sophomore, somewhere in high school, an English teacher decided on his own to ask the question in class, in his English class, before he got started with the subject of the day, would all those who are full Native please raise their hand, and would all those who are half and a quarter and this and that, which is something that the school always logged throughout the year, the beginning of the year. No one had ever done it that way, and the children were incapable of answering because they weren't comfortable answering because they were ashamed of being Native. They hid it. I can remember friends that knew, you knew they were Native, but they would refer to themselves as white Russians rather than Native. There was embarrassment at being Native.
Would you say that, or in your view, did the events and circumstances and happenings of the Civil Rights Movement, the I Have a Dream speech, have a positive impact on how Native Alaskans viewed themselves?
No. There was such a keep it quiet. It's not something you discuss outside of your home. Attitude and procedure, societal procedure, that although I may personally have thought how wonderful for a person to be a leader and attempt to guide people out of darkness,
but it didn't translate to Alaska.
Okay, the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King.
I can remember. I believe I was a young adult then, and I remember crying. I don't remember how I communicated this to friends. I believe the majority of my friends were in college at the time. College in a way.
Woodstock.
Again, being raised in Kodiak, you're out of the mainstream. It was yet another lower 48 experience that Kodiak kids couldn't relate to terribly. You know, there was a time lapse. What happened in the lower 48 and what happened here, anywhere from 2 to 7 year lapse before it hit here, be it fashion, be it political thinking, be it any kind of trend.
The Beatles.
They were a major group during my high school years, the early 60s. All those Friday night teen club dances, they had many a Beatle tune. They were a favorite of all of us kids.
Janis Joplin.
Crazy mad for her. A free spirit.
The Kent State massacres.
Saddened, horribly, appalled. They're living in a small community like this, getting used to the interaction here, the idea of violence, attempting to make a stand for something was something that was unusual here, and then to have that counteracted with violence is incomprehensible. Can't relate to it.
The 1968 Democratic National Convention.
I was starting to be quite interested in politics at that time. I believe that was the time that Nick Begich was big in Alaska, and I went to the local Democratic meetings. Again, I could dissociate at a local level and a state level, but not a national level. You're isolated here. You think in terms of small. I did anyway.
The Vietnam War.
It was very confusing. Many of my high school friends went, and some died. And it was something that we watched on TV like the rest of the nation. There we could relate with the rest of the nation because we sent people to. And we sent them and we worried about them the whole time they were there. And we were entirely in tune with the rest of the nation there. Living in fear, wanting it to be over, confused as to why it was even existing. Along in that time, I lived in Seattle for a while and they had organized demonstrations down there. I worked at a hospital in the downtown area, and I'd catch a bus and go downtown. Well, a lot of the times, you'd have to check if there was going to be a protest on, because the buses couldn't get through. I didn't feel any different than they did.
The drug scene in Kodiak.
there wasn't much of a drug scene in Kodiak in the 60s, as I knew the 60s. Again, the wave of what's going on in the lower 48 didn't strike here till later. I think it was it was the very late 60s before I even heard of what marijuana was. And some people talked about LSD and speed, but I didn't know too many who'd tried any of it.
Okay. Family values.
Well, family values, what's the question?
What comes to mind about family values when you think of your teenage years in Kodiak, your interaction with family, other families, what were their dominating mores?
Well, I moved here in 61, and my father died in 1963, and I moved out of my mother's home in 64, and I saw a variety of life, family lifestyles, because to finish school, I lived with four or five different families. Family meant a lot to me at that point in time, and just for me, it didn't happen to be gelling, but I did experience close relationships with all sorts of other families that I stayed with until I got out of school. Family means a lot to me, and eventually righted things with the rest of my family. But I think I could say family is as important to me as anyone else.
Birth control.
Yes, you mean what comes to mind?
Yeah, teenager, 60s, Kodiak.
Well, I remember I hadn't had sex until I was married, and I had some friends that had gone away to college, and I remember it was quite a big deal. They came back in the summers, and a couple of them decided that they wanted to experience sex, and we went to elaborate means of getting them birth control so they would be safe. But that's not as easy in a small town to accomplish as it might be in a larger city. So it was quite a soap opera-ish thing. I believe I was drawn into it because I was married at 19, and I forget how and what structure, but my single friends needed me to help them out to get, I forget how it was, but like I say, we were behind the times. We didn't know there was a 60s sexual revolution going on very much.
Okay, the Alaska earthquake.
Well, that was as noteworthy in my memory as the Kennedy assassination. I was living on Tagura Road at the time with my sister and her husband and three children. And they were preparing, it was a Friday, they were preparing for a party that night. We lived across the street from Larry's uncle, Benny Benson. And if it hadn't been for Benny, we might have still been sitting there, because there was the earthquake and we were frightened. Each one of us grabbed a child, and then when the shaking stopped, I remember crying because a ceramic mirror my brother gave me had broken. And after we calmed the children down, we were just sort of flustered, not knowing what to do, and starting to ask each other questions. Jerry, my sister, said, "Oh, do you think the people will come to the party? You know, this is kind of devastating." Well, none of us knew that a tidal wave would follow. We didn't know that. And Benny came and said, "Well, you better get out of here. Pack up, get out of here. We're on the water. There's going to be a tidal wave." Well, that was the first we knew. So we did. But when we did, there was no, everybody was heading up Pillar Mountain. And by the time we slowly got ourselves together, there was no room on the mountain. So we had to climb the, well, at the time I thought of it as climbing the face. Actually, it was one of the highest houses up on, I even think they call it Carlson Street, that one that goes up by Hope House. There was a house up there. It's no longer, but there was a lot up there, and it was an abandoned house. And Larry's brother and his wife and children, and Bertha and Les Martin and their children. So it was about three or four families. We went to this abandoned house. It was near Easter time, so Lorraine had brought many, many Kalich, Russian Easter bread, and somebody brought a radio, a powerful radio, and there we were. I later heard that in between the two big waves, my mother, who did live in town, and I did not live with her, drove down to my sister's house in between the waves in her Volkswagen, worried about us, wanting to know if we were okay. We spent all night up on the mountain listening to the radio reports of the radio reports going out to the rest of the world saying that Kodiak was completely destroyed. It was underwater. It was just devastating, exaggerated reports. And the men kept going downtown and down to the boats and down to check on homes and boats and things like that. And I wanted to go with them, but I was young and a girl, and there was, you know, no one was going to take me. So I remember climbing a tree, and I couldn't believe it. There was a moon out, and that's what made me climb the tree. I could see that if I would just get up a little higher, I could see what was going on. And so I did climb that tree, and I couldn't believe what I saw. I can still see those broken pieces of float with boats still tied to them, laying on their side, just kind of floating around. And there was too much water. It was like everything had stopped, but the water was covering parts of town. And I couldn't see town. I mean, there was no lights down there, like street lights or anything. So all you could see was the moon shining off the water that would just slightly illuminate this mess. Eventually, we went to the high school, which is, I think, now the junior high, to the library. Hundreds of people were there because it was too cold, and we seemed safe, so we came off the mountain, went to the school, and many, many people watched the sun come up, and that was the second most devastating thing of the experience, was watching the sun come up and look down over near the channel between Kodiak and Near Island. It was shore to shore debris. There was houses and boats and crates and just solid debris. Everything from the stores and people's, not too many homes, but lumber. And I did see a roof float by, and I don't remember people even talking. I just remember them just staring. And then a town was disrupted for some time.
How did the earthquake, or the aftermath and the aftermath, change life for you and your friends, family in Kodiak. Gonna compare and contrast before and after the earthquake.
Well, the things you would normally do were no longer done. You didn't go to school for a while until everybody got restructured. Some people lived in the school until people got placed in homes. Work and school couldn't go on about its business. There was martial law. I had a boyfriend at the time, and he lived in the downtown area, but he and his mother were ousted from their place. I remember he stayed at my sister's place for a couple of nights till his mom could find a place where they could stay, and we had no heat. I remember blankets over the door sills to keep what heat you did have in the room. Everybody slept on sleeping bags in one room. We lost our home. It was a rental down on Tagura. The people that owned it wanted it back. So we lost that and ended up in a very tiny, tiny place. Quite crowded, the three kids and Jerry and Larry and I. Things, you refocused on life and what it meant. It was a little more serious after that. I was already working. I was working as a candy striper at the hospital. Or that's about the time. No, I was working at the hospital at the time of the earthquake. I think life just became more serious because you could see how fragile it was. That's mainly how it changed. A lot of people lost homes or businesses. It kind of wiped the smiles off our faces is what it did. We were more serious.
Are there any flashes or thoughts, memories that have come up about growing up